Welcome, everyone. Addiction rarely affects just one person. It affects every single member of a person's support team, family, and friends. An addict's family and friends also need the tools to help their loved ones and help themselves. My guest today, Betsy Speer, is a licensed marriage and family therapist with more than 20 years of experience in the mental health and substance abuse treatment fields. Betsy's here today to talk to us about why a team approach to addiction and recovery is absolutely vital to success, and she will share tips for how to prepare for all the stages of treatment and recovery. Betsy has her own story and really is going to tell us a little bit about what inspired her to pursue the work in substance abuse treatment and in the world of mental health. Betsy, welcome to the show. I am so grateful to have you on.
It's really great to be on the show, Erica. Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure. And for everybody that is listening, just to disclose that Betsy was one of my professors at UCLA and absolutely the best teacher and the best mentor that probably I've ever had. And now it's an honor to be able to have you on the show and actually talk to you about all your experience and how many lives I know that you've helped change. So, you know, I just want to get started with really, you know, there's so many things to talk about in terms of recovery addiction, but really the family system is so important to acknowledge and to address, because I think a lot of people out there are suffering, family members, without getting the help that they need. And, you know, their loved one is getting help, but they don't necessarily get the help and understand the boundaries that they are going to need moving forward.
Well, I think that the families don't understand that, you know, they're very afraid. And they think that if their loved one gets help, gets clean and sober, that everything will be fine. But there is a dynamic that goes on in the family that's been going on at least as long as they've been family members, probably
right.
Even before. I mean, we all bring our stuff with us.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you know, yeah.
Oh, no. When you say stuff, though, I just, you know, for people that, you know, are a little in denial that they have stuff, don't we all have stuff? And what is that exactly?
We all have our stuff, right? We all have our experiences, our beliefs, and how we were raised as kids, and then our families' beliefs and how they were raised, and it's all passed down intergenerationally. And you know, the stuff I'm talking about is a lot of our belief systems and how we see the world and how we are in the world and live in the world.
Absolutely. I mean, that's a huge piece that really I think doesn't get talked about that often, you know, and especially as you know, we both see clients one-on-one and we're sitting across from somebody and I don't think they're really even aware that the things that they have picked up are multi-generational, intergenerational, and how we need to kind of unravel that or relearn or understand maybe the agreements we made, the subconscious agreements, would you say?
Yes. Yeah. I was sitting with a client recently, and she has no idea the impact her family had on her. And how, when she goes back to her family, that it may be very difficult for her to stay sober because they haven't changed. And she said, oh, I've changed. But sometimes that's not enough.
Right,
their
exactly.
Old ways of being will still be there.
Right. And instead of saying, you know, that the family or friends or people in your life are to blame, you know, because I think most people have to kind of look at where their responsibilities lie. But it's not about blame so much as it is getting them the help, or maybe that the person in recovery is not responsible for getting them help, but somehow creating a conversation in our, you know, in our society that everybody involved needs to be treated in a sense, or needs attention, or needs to be educated, right?
I think education for the, you know, at first it's all about education. It's like, what is the disease of addiction and how does it affect family members? What roles do the family members play in their lives, you know? When I've done family work, one of the things that I like to do first is talk about feelings, right, and do a little process on the family's feelings, with or without the identified patient, quote-unquote, right? and to see what comes up, because it's a lot of times these family members are angry, afraid, and have no clue what to do and handle how to handle what's going on. Mm-hmm. And so education is so important. But first, you have to kind of clear the mind to be able to take in information, right? So that's where the processing of, you know, feelings comes in first when I work with families.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I always hear this from families, too, that, you know, that they feel like they don't have problems, that they don't really need to learn anything, that they're just going to go with the flow of that. And that's, I don't think that's self-care in itself. I mean, I just think it's kind of being in denial that they're unaffected by something.
I was going to say it's totally denial, because they all have stuff going on around it. They all have feelings. They all have reactions. Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I think that we do when we're working with the clients is to help them not react so quickly to things, and to think before they act, you know, and it's about getting into action, not into reaction. Mm-hmm. And that's what the families have to do too, because they seem to be, when their loved one, you know, is in the depths of their addiction, they're in emergency mode all the time, always in, it's got to happen now, it's got to be right now. And mm-hmm. and it's one of the things that I know is, unless somebody is having a heart attack, a seizure, bleeding to death, we don't have to do anything right now. We can pause and wait. And then, you know, ask for the right thought, right? And act accordingly, not react. That's kind of one of the things that I work on a lot with clients and the family, is not reacting and pausing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so important. And it's such a great tip for people that are listening today. And, you know, I understand. I mean, even in my own life and my own sobriety, my own journey, I had to teach my family members how I wanted to be treated and have boundaries and teach them that I actually have a value now, which is called self-care. So I think that above all else, we need to be able to feel assertive and confident as, you know, if somebody is just newly sober listening to this today, or, you know, has been on this path for a little while. I think a lot of people are fearful of asking what they need when they are in the process of recovering or getting their life back or on a healthy path or whatever you want to call it. And how do we begin to encourage somebody that's not selfish, you know, that's called self-care? And I think I get this question a lot from people, because they're really afraid now that I put my family through so much, I've done so much damage, and now look, I'm asking for people to respect boundaries.
Well, the families have to have boundaries too, right? The family members. Everybody has to learn about what boundaries are. You know, I had a family that I was working with many years ago, and I touched the father's nose and the back of his head, and I said, this is what you're in charge of, you know, for his body, his being, right? This is what you're in charge of. And your son is in charge of the same thing for himself.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to learn how to take care of yourself, not in relation to your son, but in relation to yourself. And your son must do that the same for himself. And so it was, the father kind of was like shocked that I was like saying, you have to keep to yourself. You know, what's on the outside of your nose is really none of your business when it comes to him.
And
it was really, he was kind of shocked, but it really kind of turned the whole therapeutic relationship and process around. And the father started really taking care of himself and saying, you know what, I'm not going to come for the next weekend. I'm going to go on a hike instead, you know, that kind of thing. Because he'd been through many rounds of treatment with his child. And he was like, no, I'm not going to do it.
Right.
Not going to do it. I'm going to take care of myself next week.
It sounds like he actually heard you. Yeah.
He heard me.
Yeah.
I think he felt me too when I touched his nose.
I'm sure. That's a powerful way of, you know, explaining that to somebody. And for people that are listening that may not understand what boundaries are, I mean, they're healthy things to have to not get trampled all over, not be exploited. You're allowed to say no. You don't have to give a reason why. You know, you have to communicate in an effective way to the people in your life what is acceptable to you and what is not. And I think that when you change your life in so many ways and want to be healthy, you have certain non-negotiables that come with that. You know, you have to go to a certain amount. Right. So you have a new routine and that routine helps keep you safe and all of that. So how do you begin to explain this to families without them taking it personal? I mean, or how do you explain to this as something that is normalized and not something that is, like, scary for them?
Well, I think it is scary for them because they are used to living a certain way.
Yeah.
And what having a boundary is really taking a look at oneself and asking oneself, what is going on with me? And it's very hard for people to look at themselves, especially when they're dealing and they have been dealing with the addict in their family. It's always about the addict. And yeah, it's very hard for them to turn it around and to look at themselves. A really amazing author, Pia Melody, who writes about love addiction and codependency, talked about also having our walls, and not in an unhealthy way to have a wall, but in a really healthy way. It's like if we put a line in the sand, you know, or a wall up, it's like, I am not going to go farther than this, and you can't come on my side unless I invite you. I mean, having a healthy boundary is saying, I'm going to invite you here, and otherwise you can't come here, and vice versa. I will not cross this because this is what is safe for me. This is what I can do or can't do. And it's really about getting clear about what we need for ourselves, each person.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And I love that you said that because I really want to stress that every individual has different values, has different things that help keep them safe, that make them tick. And that is really an important process of understanding what that is, to honor that, because that's part of your truth. And I think when you lean into your truth, things become so much more clear and you begin to have a better relationship with yourself.
Yeah, and each other.
And each other,
because
right.
Because when we have an unhealthy... you know, certainly with ourselves. And then if we have unhealthy boundaries with others, we're not going to have healthy relationships with them.
Right.
Because we can't say no. We say yes when we want to say no. We say no when we want to say yes.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, and I think also, but the communication wise and internally, like the emotional boundaries are important too, you know, of saying to somebody, you know, when you guilt me, I'm going to hang up the phone, or when you are constantly raising your voice, because a lot of us have put up with certain things for years that become normal and that may not be that healthy, but yet we got so used to it. And now being clear and sober and learning all these new things, it doesn't feel good anymore. You know, you're not three sheets to the wind. That behavior doesn't resonate the same way it used to.
Right. And your families also have to get used to the fact that you know, the newly sober person is going to be saying no, 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 no in different ways now. And they are going to have a reaction to that.
Absolutely.
You know, and so it's really what happens when folks get sober then and the family and you know, the dynamic will change. But what happens is that trust has to be rebuilt. Because for both sides, you know, if we have an enabler, you know, a parent or a spouse that's an enabler, that the addict, the recovering person, really will not be asking for the same things and will not need the same thing. And so that kind of enabling, the enabler will not know how to have a relationship with the recovering person then, because they have to do it completely differently.
Absolutely.
They're not going to be asked to call in and say, tell your boss that you're sick for the 99th time, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
Or pick you up from the bar or whatever it is.
Right. Yeah. And I have a lot of clients dealing with this too. I had to deal with it in my own life too, that, you know, I had someone in my family that I used to drink with, or you have a husband that you, or wife, or friends or people in your life that you used to use with or drink with, or have, you know, somehow your substance abuse or your negative behavior was with these people, and they want you to get better. They're encouraging of that. They're proud, actually, but yet they don't know how to relate. And then when you just said that, I think that's really important to acknowledge that you can mend those relationships and create new ones. It's just a matter of really communicating, having the boundaries, and expressing to them really now what's important to you, and teaching them how you want to be treated.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So, Betsy, I know that last year you received the Distinguished Instructor Award at UCLA for, I just had to say, very proud of you. You've been teaching introduction to counseling, group counseling techniques, family counseling, and the alcohol studies department for how many years now?
It's 10 years.
Wow. Right. And it's so, yeah, exactly. And I love the saying, it's like, you know, a teacher's reach has, you know, it goes on forever. And that's kind of like what, you know, I feel when I think of you and how many people you've taught, and how many of those people go on to have their own careers and teach others and, you know, things like that. And I just wanted to, you know, if you would be open to sharing a little bit about your story, how you got into this. I think that'd be interesting for everyone to hear.
My story about teaching or what?
No, you're just in general of how you, you know, became
my recovery journey.
A pillar in the recovery world is what I think you are. So yes, if
oh
you
my
don't
God,
mind.
That's so sweet. yeah. Well, I have my own personal recovery, and I was in the restaurant business for many years, so I was very used to being around people and being in front of people as a, you know, in that business. Mm-hmm. And,
right.
You know, I got sober, and after a while, I wanted more with my life and in my life. And I went back to school in my mid-30s, I suppose. I'm going to age myself now, right? Okay. I went back to school, and I got a master's in clinical psychology, and I really loved it. And I didn't know what I was going to do with it, and I became... I started working in South Central in an amazing program down there for women and kids. And we put together the first dual diagnosis program when it was called Dual Diagnosis Instead of Co-Occurring Disorders. And that was in the mid-90s. And I, you know, I really loved working in communities and with folks. And as the years went on, I did a bunch of different things and always had a very small practice. And then I met somebody who was teaching at UCLA, and she got sick, and she needed me to fill in for her. And it was a one-day course, and I filled in this course, and I have not left. I did
awesome.
That course, then I did another course, and I'm on the committee now on the board for the drug and alcohol program. At UCLA, I just loved it. I fell in love with teaching. I seem to have a gift for it. And,
yes.
You know, I have a lot of information in my brain that, you know, I can just spew. And, you know, people seem to like my style. one of the things that I have to say is that I was a really bad student as a kid. And because I was bored. And so
yeah.
I am not a boring teacher. I certainly want the students to learn and how I think that, especially in this kind of field, how we learn is by doing. So in the group counseling classes, they're doing groups. In the individual counseling classes, they're doing one-on-one sessions with each other. In the family, in the family class, we do family. We make up families and work on families and do the dynamics. And so they really get a hands-on experience. And so when they do their internships, they've already had practice. So they're not
right.
going into their internships without, you know, having had done a group or done an intake or an assessment on a client. So
right.
pretty fun.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. That's so fantastic. And I know you're doing a lot of work today with preparing families for their loved one to get help, and also working with them after. So do you have any tips for anyone listening maybe out there today that is going through this or is starting to address this issue? I get calls a lot from mm-hmm. family members saying to me, you know, how should I approach somebody? What should I say? And for me, I always say with empathy, you know, I want to help you. I care about you, but what are some tips that maybe you've been kind of delving out with people?
Well, I've been getting calls from family members and they just need a place to talk. And, you know, it's like we do some brainstorming sessions. Do you want to do an intervention? Do you want to just kind of let your loved one be for a bit? And how are you going to be able to handle it as a family member if we just let them kind of, you know, do their own thing over here? What I like to do is give them a place to just be and ask whatever questions they need to ask. And then we kind of figure out the next step. So I'm really mm-hmm. doing family therapy. I'm not an intervention. You know,
right.
I will help them get an intervention ready. You know what I mean? I help them mm-hmm. get ready for an intervention if that's what they need.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, but that's so important to prepare. And also I think that there's so much hopelessness in terms of trying to help a loved one that so many people have said, I've been trying for years, you know,
right.
and it's getting really bad again. And I've been trying for years and they're just, and it's heartbreaking for me when I hear these kind of stories because they're really worried that their loved one is, you know, they're going to get
gonna
a call
die.
That. Right.
Going to die.
Exactly.
And then what? Right.
Right.
So it is really, I mean, one of the things that I urge people to do is to talk to somebody, ask for help. They mm-hmm. don't have to do it alone. There's still, even after all these years, a great deal of stigma around addiction and mental health issues. And I think one of the things that I try to do and that I encourage other therapists and counselors to do is to break the stigma. You know, there mm-hmm. are so many people that we know who suffer. And if we get into the feelings and into the humanity, it takes us away from the stigma. And so that's where I really work with family and my clients.
Absolutely. And just to, you know, and not to, on a serious note, but just to be realistic, this is a life or death situation for many families and many people. So this is not something to take lightly per se. But at the same time, like you said, there's so many paths to health and recovery. There's so many ways that I really urge people never to give up on their loved one. And that's, you know, I mean, my mom never gave up on me and thank God she asked me a million
exactly.
times. And I think a lot of families feel that they get so many mixed messages from different people, you know what, just cut them off or don't offer them help or, you know, whatever that is. And so
right.
I know that this is a real struggle of what is right and wrong. Honestly, I mean, there
yes.
is no.
Yes.
Yes. So
I think they have to really go into their hearts and find out what feels right for them and
mm-hmm.
and forget about everybody else and what they say and what the statistics say. But they really have to go get out of their heads and really into their hearts. It's like, what do you want to do? Do you want to go to the mat for this person, right?
Mm-hmm,
and if you
mm-hmm.
do, then how are you going to do it?
Right. Yeah,
and
absolutely.
If you don't want to, that's your choice too. And there's nothing wrong with that either. Because if you're done and you're tired and you've been doing it for years, then maybe you have to step out.
Yeah. Right. So you say that, I mean, it sounds like what you're saying is it's all upon an individualized kind of situation that not, you know,
absolutely.
There's not a blanket way to really handle that. You kind of have to dig deep down and figure out what feels right to you and maybe how hurt you are and maybe how, you know, it's affecting your life or in a very unhealthy way.
Absolutely.
Which I know it does
absolutely.
Causes such stress for people. So yeah. Well, thank you so much for all this like incredible information and just in so many ways, just how you've been helping people. I really have always appreciated watching you. And can you tell everybody where they could find you, and what you're up to today?
Well, Erica, thank you so much for having me on the show.
Of course.
You can find me. I have a Facebook page, Betsy Spear, LLMT. I am on Psychology Today. I'm in Los Angeles. Oh, one of the things that we didn't say is that I make house calls. So when families are freaking out, I will go to them.
Fantastic. That's amazing. That's amazing. And so they could get a hold of you by giving you a, getting in touch, giving you a call, and you
giving
have
me a
some,
call.
Okay, good. That's fantastic. Well, anyone that does get a hold of you is going to be very lucky, and really appreciate you being with me today.
Thank you so much, Erica.
You're listening to Rewired Radio on Radio MD. I'm Erica Spiegelman. Thank you all for joining us, and stay well.